Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Jonathan Arney. Jonathan is a partner at Shepherd Mullen Richter in Hampton. I get those, you know, I think about law firms, a ringing endorsement.
Right,
yeah, well, no, you we want to get off to a great start, so you know, I have to inject some humor at the beginning. I don't know, but you know, think about law firms. There's so many, you know, all those. You should be Shepherd Mullen.
Well, in fact, we are. We've rebranded ourselves.
Oh,
so
excellent.
No disrespect to the others that were in the name, but Shepherd Mullen is the official brand.
Okay, excellent, very good, Jonathan. Is a partner at Shepherd Mullen, and today we're going to be talking about federal audits with a special focus on GSA schedule audits. And, well, Jonathan, what's new in the audit world?
We could definitely talk an hour for that question. I guess there's a lot new in the audit world. Probably the newest of the new is a lot of contractors have had and will have these things called pre-award audits. And the GSA, Office of Inspector General, has really changed the way that they conduct pre-award audits.
How have they done that? What's going on here?
Well, they now do what they call, instead of pre-award attestation reviews, which is what they used to be called, although no one quite knew what that meant, they're now doing what they call pre-award examinations. And what that means is, rather than simply focusing on whether your submission is current, accurate, and complete, they also are now going to want to interview some of your people to look for what they call indicia of fraud. They have a list of questions they want to ask, and they actually want to conduct interviews, which frankly they never have done in the past. This is brand new.
Yeah, I don't recall that ever happening when I was still at GSA.
Right,
yeah.
Definitely not. It's very new, and it is a different way of looking, really, at a pre-award audit. The IG community says that other IGs, other auditors, have been doing this for some time, and GSA says that it is just kind of catching up with the rest of them.
Okay, trying to you know, get up to speed, so to speak, right?
So to speak. But from the contractor's point of view, though, it does require a lot more thinking, a lot more effort on their part. To make sure that everyone is up to speed on your policies and procedures, your rules and regulations. Also, contractors have to think very seriously about the position that they want to take with respect to an auditor request to interview people.
Yeah. No. Who are they? Who are they? You know. Who are they? Who do they want to interview? That's, I guess, my first question.
Right. It's. You know, so, well, first, this, as I say, is brand new. So they are still, the auditors are still figuring out as they go. I did have one auditor who told me he just wanted to hang out in our break room and interview people as they walked in and out. We thought that was not a good use of anyone's time. So we agreed, and to give the IG credit, the auditors were very accommodating. We agreed that we would come up with a list of high-ranking people. And then they could interview those people, so long as we understood the scope of the interview in advance. And that's an important point. When it happened to me recently, I made it very clear that I needed to meet with the individuals in advance of the interviews, because frankly, it's the individual's choice whether he or she wants to be interviewed. It's not the company's choice, and it's not the auditor's choice.
Right.
So rather than just saying to the auditor, okay, walk around to your heart's content, meet with anybody you want at any time, we had a much more controlled process. Therefore, the auditors got what they wanted, and we still were able to protect the company and make sure the auditor only got current, accurate, and complete information, make sure no one was surprised. You don't want any of your people being blindsided for this sort of thing, and make sure everyone, as an individual, consented to be interviewed.
Right. So they're interviewing, you mentioned high-ranking people. I assume they also want to talk to folks who are like sort of in the front lines, the direct people who are sort of managing the issues that come up in GSA schedules, whether it's IFF or, you know, the price reduction clause compliance issues, those sort of things?
Yes. You can be certain that the, for example, in a GSA schedule audit, your GSA contracts administrator is going to be on that list.
Right.
And in my recent case, the auditor wanted to talk to a director of federal sales.
Okay.
They wanted to – we kind of went back and forth on a couple of people that they initially wanted to talk to, but we didn't believe that they would really get any useful information. So I think ultimately they actually talked to someone from HR as well. They talked to the head of HR who was local and who understood the company's, for example, internal reporting policies.
Right.
You know, there was no no one demanded to talk to the CEO of the corporation, for example, and no one was really looking for the lowest level person.
Sure.
So it was a mix of management and the people, as you say, on the front lines.
So what kind of questions are they asking?
The questions are interesting. They're not trick questions by any means. The questions focused on basic ethics compliance issues. For example, one of the questions was, are you aware of any fraud going on at the company that has not been reported? We got that one right, by the way.
Yes, very good. That's an important one to get right.
Yeah, exactly. And we didn't even have to prep on that. Another one, which I found interesting, was how is the company doing financially? And the reason I guess they asked that is financial problems for a company could be viewed as an indicia of fraud or not, I guess not an indicia of fraud, but a factor that might contribute to act improperly. And there are actually a number of questions along those lines. A couple of questions. What would you do if you were aware of fraud and your supervisor were involved?
Mm-hmm.
And so those questions trying to get at the company's internal reporting policies, which, as we've talked about previously, under the mandatory disclosure rule, is very important.
Right. I'm intrigued by this just because I'm thinking about the dynamics, too, where, you know, in your role, you're representing the company, right? You don't technically represent the employees, right?
Excellent point. It's the first thing I say in every interview of an employee, obviously, right? Which, if I may digress for a second, is just a great way to start an interview in an internal
sure,
investigation
yes, right.
when you walk in and say, you know, hi, I just want you to know that I don't represent you. I represent the company.
Right, right.
But you're exactly right. We as outside counsel and inside counsel, for that matter, we're not representing the individual. We're representing the company. The good news is, however, in these situations, typically the interest of the individual and the interest of the company merges,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless, of course, the individual is an embezzler or some bad actor. But when we walk in to prepare for this sort of interview, for example, I'd go in, introduce myself, explain how the attorney-client privilege works, explain that the person does not have to meet with me, if he or she doesn't want to, explain that I represent the company, et cetera, and then explain that the company is committed to fully cooperating with the auditors, explain what the auditors are looking to do. They want to ask certain people a list of questions. I will review. I'll tell them that I will have reviewed the list in advance. It's up to the individual whether he or she wants to meet, but we as a company, you know, would like cooperation, although we will not hold it against you if you choose not to. So it's kind of a whole list, and actually I write it out because I want everyone to be read exactly the same thing.
Sure, absolutely.
And then almost always, in my experience, always, the person would say, sure, I'm more than happy to answer those
right.
questions. Because again, it's not an investigation here. It's a review. It's a little different than when I go in looking for a problem.
Right, and that's just it's interesting, and you can address this real quick. When GSA uses the term pre-award audits, we're really talking about an audit, and almost 9 times out of 10, an audit that's at the option exercise when they're taking a look back at the contractor's compliance over the first 5 years of the contract or the second 5 years. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting. The way you describe it is accurate, but there's some interesting nuances in it. You're right that pre-award audits are typically done in the renewal period,
right.
but they're primarily supposed to be focused on whether your CSPF, your commercial sales
right,
practice format,
right.
is current, accurate, and complete. So you're supposed they're supposed to be looking at that in order to advise the contracting officer going forward. But what these things really morph into in real life is a post-award look back at how you were doing in the past with respect to price reductions clause, defective pricing. Mm-hmm. And that's where they really, if you're not careful, can end up going way out of scope. And frankly, it happens a lot.
Right. Okay. And Jonathan, now we have to take a look forward and we have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more with Jonathan Ernie of Shepherd Mullen, and we're talking about federal audits. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Almost 70 years ago, a well-known Connecticut native named Homer Cummings had a dream to start a Washington law firm devoted to working at the intersection of America's business and government. As Attorney General for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was an integral part of the New Deal. In 1956, Gilbert A. Cuneo joined Cummings' firm to begin what was quickly to become the largest and most successful government contract practice in the country, earning him the title, the Godfather of Government Contracts. That same firm, McKenna, Long & Aldridge, today is recognized by Chambers USA as a Tier 1 government contract law firm, continuing its preeminence in the field through its offices in Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Denver, and San Diego. With the oldest and largest government contracts practice in the United States, McKenna, Long & Aldridge still operates at the intersection of business and government. They produce solutions by working with their clients on creative and flexible strategies that ensure success. Their attorneys and professionals include former members of government, Congress, and its committees, so they know how Congress thinks and they understand how Washington works. There is no aspect of government contracts with which they are not familiar. In this uncertain economic climate, clients trust them to deliver solutions at costs that represent real value. From one new deal to another, they have remained at the forefront of government contracting. McKenna, Long & Aldridge, a name you can trust. It's the only program of its kind in the world. A unique opportunity to help strengthen our country's defense and further your career. The National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University's School of Management. The only executive MBA degree tailored to developing leaders and managers in the U.S. defense industry. A unique combination of high-caliber executive business education, defense industry-specific knowledge, and hands-on learning designed to accelerate your career in the military, government, and corporate defense sectors. All without the career interruption of a traditional degree. Learn more at som.gmu.edu/defense. That's som.gmu.edu/defense. Do it today because the last day to apply for the fall semester is July 15th. The National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University, helping our country's defense, advancing your career.
Cellist Yo-Yo Ma, one of the great stars of classical music, enthralls audiences all over the world with his passion and artistry. When it comes to picking a cello, he tends toward Italian instruments made in the 18th century. When it comes to a timepiece, however, he favors an instrument crafted in Switzerland, the Rolex Datejust. Since Rolex introduced the first self-winding calendar wristwatch in 1945, the Datejust has become one of the most sought-after models in the Oyster line. With its classic Oyster design and magnified date window, the Datejust is every bit as distinctive as the master cellist who wears it. To see the Datejust and a complete selection of other Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
Attention employees of the intelligence community and Department of Defense. Right now, you could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com or call 1-800-826-1126. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102, contract series 83500.
Since 1886, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, D.C. has been helping children in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Now they are visited by over 3,000 children every day. The club teaches character and leadership development and arts education. No child is turned away for being unable to pay the $25 fee, and the club needs your help to make this happen. Give a gift online at bgcgw.org. The life you lift up today will be the life that brings a better world tomorrow. This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
The Performance Improvement Council, in partnership with the Department of Defense, would like to invite all federal employees to this year's Performance Symposium in Lansdowne, Virginia, June 27th through the 30th. The symposium will feature sessions led by leaders from across the federal government. Focus areas include performance, strategy, budget, and more. Spots are filling up fast. Please go to live.i6sigma.com to register with the code FEDERAL2011 or email info@pic.gov for more information.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jonathan Ernie of Shepherd Mullen, and we've been talking about audits, one of, I know, government contractors' favorite things to have to go through. When we broke, Jonathan, you were talking a little bit about the distinction between pre-award audit and post-award audits. Pick it up there.
Sure. Yeah, we were commenting that pre-award audits, as a matter of fact, often bleed into the types of topics you'd see in a post-award audit. And I guess it probably is useful to digress just a second and highlight a little bit of the difference. So as you said, Roger, a pre-award audit would occur typically at a renewal where the government is going to come in and the auditors come in and help advise the contracting officer as to whether the pricing is fair and reasonable.
Right, and that's based on the commercial sales practices that people submit, where
exactly.
You generally got to say, hey, these are all my commercial pricing practices and policies and what I do for my, you know, national accounts or whoever. You got to submit that information, and you're almost, in a certain sense, negotiating against yourself
as
a company.
Not only in a certain sense, but in every sense.
Right, right. Okay.
It has to be a very, very broad submission. Now, contrast that with a post-award audit, which is typically when the auditors are coming in because they have some suspicion that something's wrong, as opposed to just advising the CO. So a post-award audit might be in the context of a whistleblower lawsuit or a complaint by a contracting officer. It could be a complaint by a competitor. Any number. It could be a referral from an IOA, an industrial operations analyst. So some sort of suspicion that something might be wrong, and those audits are frankly far more burdensome. They're far more scary, if you will. They look in detail at price reduction clause compliance, and they look in detail at defective pricing.
Right.
They look in detail at the qualifications of your people, et cetera. And the line between a pre-award audit and a post-award audit over the years has become somewhat blurred, and you will see pre-award auditors doing things that look, feel, and smell of a post-award audit quite frequently.
Right, and that's actually where I was going to go next and ask you, you mentioned where these post-award audits come from in terms of whether it's a complaint or a whistleblower, but it theoretically also comes from, the, quote, pre-award audit and something that, a auditor becomes concerned about, and it sort of more than just, blurs the distinction of the two. It could theoretically become a sort of full-blown post-award compliance audit, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And that happens in two ways, one more formal than the other. Sometimes during a pre-award audit, the auditors will just start looking at the accuracy of your prior submissions from quite long ago sometimes. And that's what I think of as an kind of informal morphing into a post-award audit. On the other hand, to the point you're getting at, sometimes the auditors say to themselves, hey, there are some problems here, and they actually open a formal second audit, which is a post-award audit, which is, it will take on a life of its own.
What are the other areas you think are high risk? I have my list. Let me hear your list.
Yeah, okay. defective pricing, and now let me explain what that means, because defective pricing technically isn't a GSA schedule term, but the concept's the same. The concept is when you give information to the government, it has to be current, accurate, and complete. So when you complete your CSPF, for example, what some companies do is they fail to provide the government all their commercial sales practices. Maybe they don't tell them about a certain discount a certain type of company gets. Maybe they fail to tell them that they give rebates from time to time. And the failure to give current, accurate, and complete information can cause can cause a lot of problems and lead to what we generally call defective pricing. So that's a big risk area, failure to submit a current, accurate, and complete CSPF.
Do you think, and just I'm sorry to interrupt for a second, but just I have a question. That is, and it's been rolling around my mind, one of the things that some GSA contracting officers now are asking their companies to do is to submit some analysis, price analysis, essentially comparing their proposed product or their offered product to competitors. And, you know, I guess for purposes of trying to figure out whether price is fair and reasonable, could that information theoretically, you know, rise to, you know, if you don't do a good job at it and when you submit it, or could somebody come back and say, hey, well, you missed this particular one? Does that create problems, do you think, or not? I'm just...
Well, the short answer is yes, it can create problems, but let me... I want to comment on one thing first, which I just think is kind of ironic about that trend. For years, when companies wanted to show that their pricing was fair and reasonable, they would look to their competitors to say, hey, this pricing is fair. Just look at the marketplace. And in response to that, the GSA CO contracting officer would routinely look back at us and say, I don't care how your pricing relates to other companies. I only care about how your pricing to me relates to your pricing to your other customers. So there is a certain amount of irony that this new practice is really directly opposed to what was always the mantra of the contracting officers. With respect to your question about whether there's a risk of fraud risk here, and fraud is the term we use for really if the government's going to be investigating any misstatements,
yes,
they investigate under fraud. The answer is for sure, because every time you make a submission to the U.S. government,
you're making a representation, right?
That's exactly right. And and there's really little difference between those data you would provide and any certification you might fill out.
Yeah.
And so if you get it wrong, you know, if you don't put in due diligence, you could actually be held accountable for providing faulty information about other people, other customers. So I would think twice, and I would have a heck of a lot of caveats as to where those data come from, what they mean, what they are not.
And sure, to lay out, this is the process I used, and disclose that to the CEO if you're going to be asked to do that. So at least you're putting them on notice of what you did.
Right. I think that's exactly right, Roger. Look, if I were going to go and do that, and I were just going to look at a couple of companies' websites, okay, kind of a cursory search, I would be very specific telling the CO exactly that. You know, as you said, this is what I did. Step one, you know, turned on the computer, opened up to the internet, looked at these three, maybe not that specific, but I looked at these three websites, I pulled the information publicly available, and I make no representation beyond that's what I saw on that day.
Right. That's very good. Other compliance areas, I think, you know, is Trade Agreements Act still a big issue?
Yeah, it is. Trade Agreements Act is still a big issue. There are still multiple investigations going on by the Office of Inspector General. And interestingly, there is also still a number of key TAM, False Claims Act lawsuits, being brought in the Trade Agreements Act world. And some of these are particularly creative, and they highlight the lengths to which some of these plaintiffs will go to try to bring suits. One of my favorite ones, just to briefly summarize it, is this out-of-work lawyer went into a courthouse out west somewhere, and he looked at the back of all the computers, and he found the ones made in China. And then he went to GSA Advantage, and he sued every company that had that model. He had no evidence that anyone actually sold anything to the government, but he sued over 30 companies under the False Claims Act, alleging a Trade Agreements Act violation. Now, ultimately, his case was thrown out of court, and it was dismissed with prejudice. However, you know, a fair amount of time and effort and money went into having to defend against that. So not only does the IG continue to focus on TAA, but the plaintiffs are still looking at that area.
Right. Well, you know, Jonathan, right now we do have to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking more to Jonathan Ernie of Shepherd Mullen. And we're talking about federal audits. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
What do successful small, medium, and large federal contractors, including two-thirds of the top 100, have in common? Membership in the Coalition for Government Procurement. Successful federal contractors know they get the information edge they need on developing acquisition trends and an effective voice to protect their interests from coalition membership. For nearly 30 years, the Coalition's been the trusted voice of industry, working with federal officials to promote common sense procurement. Know what the best know. Join the Coalition today to protect and grow your company's business. Contact the Coalition at 202-331-0975 or visit their website at thecgp.org. That's 202-331-0975 or thecgp.org. Don't be left wondering what will happen to your federal business. Contact the Coalition today.
What if learning a new language was as easy as watching your favorite TV show or playing your favorite video game? What if, while you were having your morning coffee, you could learn how to speak or read a new language? Well, now you can. Introducing an all-new, more powerful Rosetta Stone. Developed to fully immerse you in your new language, the all-new Rosetta Stone software is now easier than ever before. You can learn your new language on your computer, then practice in your car or on your smartphone or MP3 player without ever opening a book or memorizing a single word. It's never been easier to learn a new language. And to celebrate, Rosetta Stone is giving away free demo CD-ROMs of their all-new language immersion technology. To get yours absolutely free, call now, 1-800-900-2599. Immerse yourself in your new language. Call now and receive your free demo CD-ROM of the all-new Rosetta Stone software. 1-800-900-2599. For your free demo, call 1-800-900-2599.
Even my wife really doesn't understand what I do. She calls it cyber chess. Actually, that's close. As a cyber specialist, I help clients understand the critical moves they need to make before an attack occurs. It's more than just data security. It's the full cyber life cycle.
In a certain context, I'm like my brother. He's preventing crime patrolling the streets. I spend my day online ensuring our clients' data and information systems are secure. It's what I do. I'm good at it.
For a cyber career that's something truly extraordinary, look no further than the strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton. As a global leader in cybersecurity, Booz Allen offers competitive salaries and benefits, ongoing training, and the opportunity to work with recognized cyber thought leaders at a company committed to helping you get the most out of work and life. That's why Fortune named them one of America's 100 best companies to work for again.
That's why I chose Booz Allen.
That's why I chose Booz Allen. For a cyber career that's something truly extraordinary, visit BoozAllen.com/FED. Booz Allen is an equal opportunity employer.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the only radio station dedicated to news for and about the federal government and government contractors. Find us at federalnewsradio.com.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
While the wheel was being invented, prehistoric man probably took a snack break. And today, we still grab a little something-something to tide us over when we're on the job. Something sweet or salty or fatty. Unfortunately, those snacks often end up lowering our energy level. And a poor diet can increase our weight while decreasing our ability to work effectively. At Kaiser Permanente, we just think the work snack needs updating. Say, fruit bowls and veggie plates at meetings, or putting locale choices in the vending machines, even lunchtime trips to local farmers markets. It's total health thinking. That's what Kaiser Permanente does for employers that choose us. Provides tools for companies to keep employees healthy and productive. Find out how a Kaiser Permanente plan can help your employees and your business thrive. Go to kp.org/thrive9to5.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jonathan Ernie of Shepherd Mullin, and we've been talking audits. You know, one of those favorite topics of government contractors.
There's no better way to wake up in the morning.
Yeah, absolutely, with your audit ready to go. And Jonathan, we were running through some of the key, you know, risk areas or compliance issues that our focus is focused on in audits. And you know, we left off with the Trade Agreements Act. Is there another one that's pretty big these days?
Yeah, there are a couple more, but there's one in particular that I just see an awful lot of, and it's the auditor's focus on whether the people you're providing to handle services have the qualifications that are required by the schedule. And so routinely now in a pre-award audit, the auditors will ask for the actual resumes, at least for service companies, the actual resumes of the folks that are being used to work the federal jobs, and they'll compare the qualifications in the resume to the qualifications required in the schedule contract. And if they don't meet, it's a problem. The auditor's view is that a government purchaser cannot voluntarily accept someone with lower levels of qualifications unless the schedule provides for kind of a education/experience trade-off. So it puts companies at great risk because a lot of times the government customer comes to them and says, hey, I want to use Bill or I want to use Mary. And Bill and Mary might not have the necessary degrees, and the company wants to do what the customer wants, but the company puts itself at risk, and auditors will almost always look for this exact issue.
Yeah. So now we've got Trade Agreements Act, we've got labor categories, we've got price reduction clause, and then disclosure issues. So big question: how do, as a company, when you get tapped on the shoulder and it's your turn for the audit, how do you prepare for that? What are some of the key things that companies need to keep in mind?
Sure. And I guess there's actually there's two parts of that question. There's the specific one you asked, which is what do you do once you get the tap on the shoulder? And then there's the second piece, which is, okay, what should you have been doing prior to that? So let me start with the one prior to that, if that's okay.
Oh, absolutely.
And then hit once you get the tap on the shoulder. And since I guessed you were going to be asking me these questions, I had a discussion.
How did you guess that?
Well, I your stuff, and I
okay.
Figure this is what would happen. So I had a discussion with an expert this morning, so I'd be ready for this. So I talked to my 7-year-old daughter, Alexis.
Okay.
Yeah, and I asked Alexis. First, I had to explain what a federal audit was, which took all of breakfast.
Okay.
But I finally got her to understand that, and then I said, okay, well, what should...
That's pretty good, though, if she has the attention span to do that. I know same age. He's like, Dad, I'm going downstairs to...
she was very, very interested in this, actually.
Okay.
And so I explained it to her, and then I said, okay, well, what should companies do to prepare for these things? And so she actually gave me a list. I'm not making this up. And I think her list is particularly good here.
Okay.
One is, you have to have good pricing, Daddy, she said. And now she said your prices have to be good. So which is absolutely a critical factor. You have to have policies and procedures in place to make sure your pricing consistent with your schedule contract on the federal side and on the commercial side. Obviously, I'm supplementing what she said a little
bit. Right, sure.
But that's a core being ready for an audit and ensuring compliance area. The second thing she said, which is probably the best one, is you got to follow the rules, Dad.
Right, absolutely.
which in our house you'd think would be nice if that ever happened.
Yes.
But apparently she believes that's a good thing for companies, but not for
other
children
people
in the Arony household. Nonetheless, so having policies and procedures in place and actually following them is critical. The other one she said I love, and I can't really overemphasize this one. She says you have to make bad people leave the company. Right? And now the first thing she said is you have to put them in jail. And then she backed off that a little bit and said, no, you just have to make them leave the company. And the reason I focus on that one, which I love so much, is it's a mistake a lot of companies make, is they aren't willing to discipline the wrongdoers in the company. And then what happens is you get an audit. The auditors find, say, a price reductions clause violation, and they say to you, okay, well, what happened to the person who didn't follow your rules? And you kind of sheepishly say, she was promoted to vice president.
Right.
Instead of being able to say, well, she was disciplined, or she was, you know, as my daughter said, leave the company. She had to leave the company. And my, her last one, by the way, is that the company should be nice to girls. But I guess we could tie them to some socioeconomic program. But
sure. Well, you know, and that one bad people leaving the company. Well, that's, you know, there's a mandatory disclosure rule, right? And you know, parts of it apply to the GSA schedules because of commercial contracts. But fundamentally, I always view, the business ethics plan and compliance plans that the clause calls out is something, even if it doesn't apply to a commercial contract, they're really telling you, it's something you ought to be doing.
Well, you know, it's the utter irony of that rule. So, first of all, the disclosure rules clearly apply to everybody. But as far as the ethics, the wonderful list of internal control system elements, hey, so the government in its wisdom says commercial items companies, small businesses, you don't have to comply with this list. And it's the one list out there that every company should comply with to protect themselves.
Right.
And so the suggestion that companies don't have to comply with the one thing that would actually save them against a charge of recklessness is it's a sad structure. But you're exactly right. Every company should look at that internal control list. And for those of you playing the home game, it's 52-203-13.
Yes.
And check off those boxes, even if you're a small business, commercial items company, what have you.
Okay, now turning to, now you've been tapped on the shoulder.
Okay, excellent, right. So the first thing companies need to do is they need to understand that an audit, whether it's pre-award or post-award, is not just a routine contract management issue. Okay? It's an issue that your in-house law department needs to know about. And the reason I say that first is I have had many situations where the in-house law department, calls me and they say, hey, Jonathan, I just found out we have auditors coming in today. And I say, how is it that you just found out today? And they say, well, the contracts just let me know. But you can't view that this way. This is something that takes a lot of preparation because you're making representations to the government again, and anything that goes wrong here could quite easily lead to a False Claims Act investigation, or if they go really wrong, they could lead to a suspension or a debarment or what have you. So step number one is treat it seriously, contact your in-house counsel. I'd say the next thing which is critical is you obviously have to fully cooperate with the auditors, and you want to, frankly. It's, gone are the days of old when, the auditors would come and you'd put them in a windowless room in the basement. That's like shooting a bear with a BB gun, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
The key is to fully cooperate, get them what they want, so long as it's within their rights, quickly, efficiently. The faster the audit goes, the better it is for everybody. Okay? And so some upfront planning is pretty useful. Talk to the IG early, the auditor early, about what data he or she really, really needs.
Right.
How long it'll take to get it. Keep everyone up to speed throughout. The other thing I'd add is you want to get ahead of the ball. You don't want to be finding out that there are problems, months into the audit. So what I like to do is I like to start a privileged internal review. So we know what's going on, and therefore, obviously, not so we can hide something, but so we can explain it in proper context as necessary during the course of the audit.
Sure. All right. Well, with that, Jonathan, we do have to take another break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Jonathan Ernie of Shepherd Mullen, and we've been talking federal audits, and we'll keep going down that road. This is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com takes a look at the issues surrounding cloud computing through the eyes of those who are using it every day. We'll share with you the challenges, opportunities, and lessons learned from some of the top minds in the world of federal IT. Collaborate with others and help shape the discussion on cloud computing at the FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com or follow the FedCloud blog on Twitter. The FedCloud blog is sponsored by Cisco and Intel.
Listen to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, every Friday morning at 11 o'clock. Brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bradford, and Roth, Fed Talk features live interviews with guests from the federal community sharing their insights on issues that affect you. Call in or email questions or comments to fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Fed Talk is sponsored by GEICO. This week, host Deborah Roth will take a look inside the intelligence community and IC collaboration with Booz Allen Hamilton Executive VP Richard Wilhelm and the FBI Intelligence Analyst Association.
There is a watchmaking standard that is revered around the world. That standard comes from Rolex. From clasp to bracelet to its unique watertight oyster case, a Rolex holds its value because it was intended to. Crafted from just three precious metals, platinum, steel, and gold, each defies the ordinary. Its steel, 904L, virtually indestructible and corrosion resistant, is incomparable. Its patented Everrose Gold, created in an exclusive foundry, will remain beautiful for life. Inside, a genuine Rolex movement is a product of superiority and remarkable testing. It is unrivaled. At Rolex, flawless standards create more than a watch. They create a value that was meant to endure. For a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store since 1900. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
Cybersecurity. Private and government enterprises recognize it as an imperative in today's complex, information-dependent world. So who better than UMBC, a leader in science and technology education and research, to offer a master's and graduate certificate in cybersecurity? Learn more about UMBC's cybersecurity programs and find information about UMBC's upcoming fall semester at umbc.edu/cyber.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit myvillagegreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Zymogen and Metagenics.
Celebrate summer and support the Boys and Girls Clubs at Safeway's Barbecue Battle, June 25th and 26th on Pennsylvania Avenue. This great family event features the nation's best barbecue, along with 30 great rock, R&B, and blues bands, plenty of free food samples, celebrity chefs, contests, prizes, and more. Easy to get to by Metro. Call 202-828-3099 or visit bbqdc.com. See you at the barbecue.
Welcome back to Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jonathan Ernie of Shepherd Mullen, and we're talking about federal audits. And Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about, in the GSA schedule context, you have your audits that we've talked about, pre-award and post-award, but you also have this thing, and I think you mentioned it in one of our earlier segments, these industrial operation analysts who work for GSA. They're not auditors, but what are they, and what is a IOA review?
In a lot of companies' minds, an IOA review is an audit. And in fact, when I go into a client and we're getting ready for an OIG audit, and I ask them, have you been audited before? I frequently will get the incorrect answer, yes, we have. We've been audited every year, and we pass with flying colors. Now, when they say that, what they're actually talking about is, as you mentioned, is an IOA review or a customer assistance visit. And frankly, these while they are reviews and while they should be treated in some respects like an audit, they're absolutely not the same thing as an OIG audit. The IOAs come in and they will look at some of your pricing approaches. They will make sure you're paying your industrial funding fee. They'll actually talk to you about some of your systems. There is a helpful component to it, especially for small businesses. There's also, as I said, an audit component to it. I used to, frankly, diss on the IOA reviews all the time because I thought they were done very, very poorly. I will say that over the past maybe 2, 3, or 4, maybe even longer, 5 years, they've definitely gotten better. They've become more professional. They know what they're talking about right, far more than they ever did in the past. But here's the risk for companies. Companies generally, frequently will pass with flying colors, if you will. They'll get a great report card, and then they'll think everything's fine. And then the auditors come in and do a real audit and find real problems. And unfortunately, the fact that you have a positive report card from an IOA means absolutely nothing to an OIG investigator.
Sure. Yeah, because it's almost a contract. It is a contract administration function, fundamentally, the IOAs, and the IG and audit is a much different thing.
No, that's exactly right. And so I have a lot of Trade Agreements Act investigations going on, and I was talking to a government agent not long ago on one of these, and she was, you know, taking issue with some of our systems. She thought they weren't adequate. And my response was, well, agent so-and-so, we had an IOA review, and we passed with flying colors. And the agent looked at me and said, you know what I think about those reviews.
Right, okay.
So, you know, so you can't – look, a good one is a lot better than, as we say, you know,
yeah,
poking the eye with a stick.
Ones. Right, yeah.
But you can't overly rely on them, and you can't let them lull you into a false sense of complacency.
Right.
That's, I think, the important lesson there.
And do sometimes the IOA reviews lead to actually – things going to the IG?
They can. I don't think it happens that often, but I definitely have had IG investigations that have flowed out of OIA reviews, especially if you're not cooperative with the – I said OIA. If you're not cooperative with the IOAs,
yeah.
That more likely it'll lead to an IG investigation or audit.
Well, so we've talked about these IOA reviews. We've talked a lot about audits. One thing I didn't ask you about before, and I think it's important to talk about a little bit, is – so you've given great advice about, you know, preparing for an audit and having the systems in place. What are the consequences if an audit doesn't go well? I mean, that's the flip side of things, that you know that magnifies the importance of that preparation.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of potential consequences. The consequence that you're most worried about if an audit doesn't go well is turning into a False Claims Act investigation. And in past shows we've talked about the False Claims Act, and I know a lot has been written about it. But the basic concept is if a company submits a claim or a statement to the government that's false and does so recklessly, well, that is the basis potentially for a False Claims Act allegation, and the penalties of that are huge. It's 3 times actual damages plus $11,000 per violation, and that would
right.
be per invoice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's primarily what you're worried about, something jumping from a contract audit to a False Claims Act world problem. Now, there are obviously other potential problems, too. If you're truly irresponsible, you could have a suspension debarment risk, which means you can't play in the federal sandbox anymore.
Right, right.
You could, if someone's intentionally out there violating the rules, you could have a criminal problem. But really, there's a lot to be worried about. But the False Claims Act issue is the primary real life risk.
And Jonathan, you've been doing this for years now, right?
You can tell from my lack of hair, can't you?
Yeah, yes. Well, I'm getting there fast myself.
I have a hairline for radio.
Well, can you talk a little bit about what you see in terms of changes and trends? And I guess in particular, there's a lot made today between the relationship or the interaction between contracting officers and auditors. How has that changed over time?
Well, one trend I already mentioned, which is since I dissed on the IOA so much, I should just mention again, is they have gotten better. So
yes.
I will start with a positive trend. Another trend I see is exactly the one I think you have in your mind, I'm guessing, because the relationship between the IG auditor and the contracting officer has changed significantly. In days of old, the contracting officer would definitely play the lead role. The auditor in an pre-award audit context, for example, would do the review and then advise the CO, and then the CO would make the decision and as to what was going to happen with the contract. And technically, that structure still exists. But in practice, the IG auditors have taken on a far stronger role. The CO, I have seen, the contracting officers, are far more willing to defer, either out of respect or fear, defer to the auditors. And I've even had situations where the auditor sat at the negotiation table and led the negotiation. Now, that is not the way it was intended to work, but I think it is an example of how the strength of the IG over time has grown, and contracting officers have become, perhaps for good reasons, a little more nervous and a little more apprehensive in being creative. That's probably the biggest trend that I've noted.
Right. Well, the COs have their warrant. Do you think part of that is that we have, the acquisition workforce over the years has been cut significantly now, just both like DOD, even GSA as well. are trying to rebuild that workforce. Do you think there's also just a lack of, I think, you know, whether it's seasoning or what, or experience in terms of the COs that, you know, you've got, they're going through a, you know, a sort of tough stretch right now in terms of, you know, lots of on-the-job training kind of thing. Do you think that has something to do with it?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with it. Like there are still some great contracting officers out there, some COs that really are professional. They know their role. They know how to negotiate. And in those cases where those COs are in play, the relationship between the auditor and the CO is as you'd expect. But there are a large number of COs that don't have that experience, and there's definitely a problem with let's say inexperienced COs, sure. And in those situations, I think that's where you see kind of this imbalance occur.
Yeah. And speaking of balance, you know, one of the things that strikes me is that with the price reduction clause still in place, but at the same time now you've got the new competitive ordering procedures for schedules, it does raise to me that question, is the clause even relevant to the GSA schedule program anymore? Because you've got to compete every order over $150,000. I mean, and competing means providing all the schedule contractors an opportunity, you know, to a notice and an opportunity to submit a response or a quote. So what do you think?
Well, it certainly is. It's much harder to justify the need for the price reductions clause with so much competition, with the requirement for competition that in other areas of government contracting, that's enough to get fair and reasonable pricing. So I think that the change in the GSA ordering rules is definitely another check mark on the side of the ledger that says we do not need the price reductions clause. There are a lot of other check marks on that side too. The problem is that every time the argument's made, the IG community points to all these companies who have settled multi-million-dollar False Claims Act price reduction clause violations, and the auditors and IG community says, well, we clearly need it because people aren't following it.
Well, if people aren't following because it's almost impossible to comply with, quite frankly.
You're not going to get an argument with me on that one, Roger.
So there's going to be problems. You may create a clause that's impossible to comply with if you're a commercial contractor, then you're going to have violations.
Precisely.
So John, my last question to you, and that is, I mean, this has been really good stuff. Where can you learn more about audits and what's going on with GSA schedules?
Well, I'm going to use that question as an opportunity to make a quick pitch here, because as it turns out, I teach my advanced issues course tomorrow, and you can look online, West Federal Publication Seminars, and I teach it with a good gentleman who you probably know well, Larry Allen.
Yes, I know Larry.
It's a two-day advanced issues course, and I'm happy to pitch it because I make $0 for it. but you can find that online. That's a good place. There are also a number of other courses and a lot of good articles. And, in fact, the Coalition's newsletter is terrific, by the way. I should give you a pitch
for that.
Well,
thank you very much. I appreciate that. So we're at the end of the segment. I want to thank Jonathan Ernie of Shepherd Mullen for joining me today. I'm Roger Waldron, and this is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.